What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Michael the Pod Pina, an NBA writer for Sports Illustrated, and I have a very special surprise in the form of some very special news. Last week, Chris Herring, my colleague at SI, made his Open Floor debut as my Thursday co-host, and you can hear the two of us every week throughout the playoffs right here, of course. But just as exciting, on Mondays, I will have a different new co-host. He's another genuine basketball genius, one of the most talented writers and most beautiful people alive, my Sports Illustrated colleague and fellow Jimmy Butler stan, the great Rohan Nadkarni. Rohan, welcome to Open Floor. Please introduce yourself to the people.
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you so much for that beautiful introduction, Michael. I'm really excited to be doing the show with you. I feel like it would be crazy if I didn't acknowledge the outstanding work you've done on this podcast, the outstanding work my old colleagues Ben Golliver and Andrew Sharp have done. I understand that there are a lot of devoted Open Floor fans, and rightfully so. This is a mega popular podcast, so I'm humbly taking the co-host chair today, and I understand that people take this podcast seriously. It's for a lot of people where they get their basketball news from. I'm just going to do my best. I know I can't replace those who sat in this chair before me, but hopefully we can still have a lot of fun here.
Ton of pressure. No, just be yourself. You're great. You're amazing. You're going to do wonderful. Open Floor Globe, embrace Rohan. He's wonderful. He's really smart. We have a lot to get to on today's show, including tons of wonderful questions emailed in from you guys, our listeners. But first, Rohan, we got to react to the opening weekend slate of game ones. Basically, in my opinion, every game was good, at least. Like,
yes.
That's the low bar for me. Ja Morant continued to take the league by storm last night against the Jazz. My beloved Rob Williams officially turned into Bill Russell. That was really awesome to see. Hawks-Knicks yesterday was a religious experience. But I want to start with arguably the most intriguing series out West, where LeBron James and the Los Angeles Lakers now trail 0-1 to Devin Booker's Phoenix Suns. And my question to kick it off to you, Rohan, is just, it's a slightly weird one. But given Chris Paul's shoulder injury, where, you know, he went down early in that game and said afterwards, I think that he heard a crack in his elbow. So that's just like that's not good news. And did not play particularly well after returning from the shoulder injury. But, you know, the Lakers were the team that lost the game. So like, who should be more concerned after game one between these two teams, Rohan?
So the crack thing was weird. I don't know about you, but every time I watched that replay, I was like, what happened? Tell me how he got hurt exactly. In no way am I saying that Chris Paul is dogging it, but every time I watch the replay, I don't quite understand the injury. I don't understand what could have cracked there unless it was his collarbone or something like that. I mean, maybe it was. Who knows? I bet this is one of those injuries where we won't find out how severe it is until after the playoffs, but I think the Lakers have to be more concerned, if only because we just saw them lose to Chris Paul with one arm. He played most of that game. He looked like he could not dribble. He was clearly had no desire to shoot. The only time he shot really was when he kind of had to. And even then, I mean, most of them he left, you know, in front of the rim, etc. So just based off the strength of the Suns already winning that game with one-armed Chris Paul and the Lakers being down 1-0, I think they kind of have to be the team in more trouble.
Interesting. I kind of feel, you know, if Chris Paul looks like he did after he came back from that injury for the rest of the series, I don't think that Phoenix, you know, I don't want to say they don't have a chance, but there was a lot of stuff in that game one where, like, you look at what the Lakers did and you're just kind of like, oh, the Lakers can make an adjustment here. The Lakers can tweak their lineup here. The Lakers can post LeBron James more than four times in the entire basketball game, which I feel like, you know, there's this saying that like the playoff series do not begin until the road team wins. And I think it should change to playoff series don't begin until LeBron James decides he wants to post up on the block repeatedly. That's like how I feel about this Lakers team, because, you know, offensively, really struggled. Their offensive rating in game one was 97.8, which is atrocious. And I don't think they got below that number throughout the entire regular season in games that LeBron played in. So it was pretty abnormal. I will say, like, Anthony Davis was just, he was terrible in game one. And usually when he has performances like this, he bounces back in a big way. And I almost expect him to drop a 50 ball in game two. But I look at the rotation that Frank Vogel has going, and, you know, a lot of people have been texting me, just like casual fans and people around the league. Just, you know, the Andre Drummond situation is, it's getting a little dire. I mean, he played 19 minutes beside Anthony Davis in this game. I mean, I think that was all of his minutes. LA's offensive rating was 102. In that time, just like really rough stuff. So, like,
go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, like, if you're the Lakers and you're trying to feel optimistic, it's like, okay, let's just not play Andre Drummond, who did not play a single second in the fourth quarter. Your boy Alex Caruso played the entire fourth quarter, and I think that they may want to start Caruso. I tweeted this. But they may want to start Caruso either in game two or game three. I don't know. Like, the front court rotation is just so strange. Are you feeling confident in the Lakers making these adjustments and them having an impact, Ron?
I am, only because this is something that we would ask Frank Vogel about after almost every game last year, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you guys really looked better out there with AD at the five. I think it's obvious that the Lakers made some combination of a promise to Andre Drummond that he's going to start if they sign here, and some kind of promise to Anthony Davis that we're not going to play you at center every single game, even though for 2 years running now, that's when they've looked their best. I mean, even last year in the finals, you know, I think the Heat were so decimated that the Lakers had such a big margin of error that they could start Dwight, they could start a center, and then you see them in game six, we're like, okay, fine, like, we're just going to put AD at the five, and then they go, you know, Death Star in that game. Mm-hmm. I don't know what is holding them back. I don't think it's as simple as Frank Vogel doesn't know what he's doing, because I think he's proven to have made pretty good adjustments. And, you know, for what it's worth, they did have moments during their playoff run last year where having a center did help them. They know when this team is at their best. It's the lowest hanging fruit. And I think AD, this happened in that Warriors game too, he kind of gets off to a slow start in the play-in game, and then, you know, fans get upset, AD's not playing well, etc. I just don't think they're putting him in a position to succeed at the start of these games by making him play next to Drummond. He just gets such better looks when he's playing center. Why not put him in a position to get in his rhythm earlier in the game? I'm confident that Vogel will make the adjustment, because I think if anything, he's shown over the last couple of years, it's a willingness to adjust his rotation, you know, ride the hot hand, find the veteran who has it. If there's a worry I have for the Lakers, you know, their three-point shooting was bad in game one. I think we have some reason to believe it'll be a little bit better in game two. But this team is, since LeBron has gotten there, has still never really had great shooters on it. And I think if there's one worry I have for them moving forward, it's, even when you do move AD at the five, Caruso is my boy, and I do think he should play more. The shooting, I think, has to be a little bit of a concern, because, for lack of a better phrase, like, it was a little fluky in the bubble.
I mean, spot on. I totally agree with you, and I've been saying this for a while now. Now, I picked against the Lakers in every series last season, I want to say. Maybe I picked, I can't remember if I picked them against the Nuggets, but I let's just say, for the sake of this discussion, that yes, I picked against the Lakers in every series last year. And part of that was because of, you know, I had some doubts about AD, particularly playing the four, particularly in half-court settings where, you know, their offense was not very efficient throughout the regular season, and they don't have a ton of spacers, as you said, Rohan. And I look at this year's team, and it's just a bunch of the same. But this year's team was constructed with such investment at the center position in guys who are not Anthony Davis. So, like, I look at Montrezl Harrell, who's, you know, he looks okay when he's out there, but he's just not getting any minutes. There's, like, no opportunity for him to establish any sort of rhythm whatsoever. I don't anticipate him playing over 20 minutes in any of these games, which is a big bummer for him because he gave up a lot of money to be in this situation. We just addressed Andre Drummond, who played as many minutes as Kyle Kuzma in this one, which is pretty interesting. And if, you know, if I'm Marc Gasol, by the way, who started the season at the five for the Lakers in units that were really dominant on both ends, I would just be stewing. Like, what is going on? Why can't I play?
I think he's more than stewing. I think he's been pretty publicly vocal about his displeasure at the rotation. I do have some sympathy for Frank Vogel, who is managing more than just egos, but high-powered agents and high-powered players, etc. I think it's a more difficult job than he's been given credit for to kind of keep a lid on things there. But we're starting to see it a little bit this year. I mean, you know, there was a game or two where Montrez was held out of the rotation. He was kind of just like, hey, man, I don't make the decisions. Gasol has been, you know, thinly veiled with his displeasure at the rotation. And you're right. Their original starting five, the one that we kind of all thought was going to be really, really good when they made the moves they made in the offseason, was playing incredibly well. The Lakers maybe did a little bit too much tinkering, you could even argue, you know, during the regular season, because when they were starting Gasol and everyone was healthy, they were playing incredibly, incredibly well. I mean, that was when LeBron looked like he was going to win MVP, et cetera. I just don't understand why they start every playoff series or have started every playoff series the last couple years behind the eight ball a little bit. And it's almost like a stubbornness, like, let's see if this works, as we know how good we are when we actually play our best five players at once. But if we can get away with this, then why not? I don't understand why they decide to go that route.
Right. The idea is, you know, we are going to be humongous. Like, we're going to play LeBron, who, for all intents and purposes, is a four. Like, we're going to play LeBron at the three. You have no one who can guard him and AD, plus a five who should be dominating on the glass. And our defense is just going to be humongous. We're going to be physically, you know, we're going to physically overpower you on both ends in the paint. But, like, I just don't think that Drummond is that guy. And particularly, like, in the full court, in full court action, he just doesn't run the floor at all. And that's problematic for obvious reasons when you see, you know, fast break opportunities where the Suns are just getting buckets and he's out of the camera frame entirely, which happened a bunch of times in game one that I noticed. But I want to, you know, I think Phoenix Suns fans are probably screaming at us right now for not giving credit to their team and how well they played. DeAndre Ayton was a total beast in this game. I thought their defensive strategy was on point, and Devin Booker basically played the entire game and was absolutely lights out despite all the attention that he received from the best defense in the NBA. So, Rohan, you actually wrote a piece, today's daily cover, actually, on SI.com that everyone can go check out about the Suns. You spoke to James Jones. What are your thoughts about Phoenix right now in this series? What are your thoughts more broadly about the Suns? Just, you know, their ceiling with this unit. Just what's your feel?
I mean, I'm happy for them, certainly. It's crazy to think that it was only a couple years ago when the only thing people were talking about the Suns was like a bunch of goats pooped in Ryan McDonough's office. Like, that was that was like their only like representation in the national conversation. For 2015 to 2019, they never won more than 25 games in the season. People were wondering if Devin Booker was ever going to be someone more than just a scorer on a bad team. And, you know, I don't think James Jones himself would say, I deserve all the credit. That certainly was not what he was saying to me when we spoke. But I thought he made a great point, which was, you know, a lot of teams want to be great. A lot, you know, we talk about ceilings all the time, but I had to raise the floor. And you think about a lot of the moves he made that first summer that I think a lot of us, just because it was the Suns, kind of had our eyebrows raised. You know, he didn't hit every move out of the park. He kind of dumped away TJ Warren, which ended up being a mistake. But, you know, bringing in a Dario Saric, taking a chance on Cameron Johnson in the draft, you know, revitalizing a guy like Cam Payne's career, even just, you know, firing their old coach, bringing in Monty Williams, a guy who's respected around the league. All those moves, I think, laid the groundwork for what they did in the bubble last year when they went 8-0 and just actually had competent guys on the floor. You know, having a point guard like Ricky Rubio, who's like by 10 degrees the best point guard Devin Booker had ever played with at that point. That made it an attractive destination for Chris Paul. And, you know, those go hand in hand. They got lucky. A superstar was on the market. And they've really taken off. You know, this is so tough because they are playing the Lakers in the first round that I do think they kind of have what it takes to make a deep playoff run. It's just is, it's almost like they're either going to get out in the first round or make it to the finals. That's just the kind of vibe I have with this team. The West is so wide open this year, but I think James Jones has like genuinely done a great job. And it's funny to hear a GM say, you know, we actually had to raise the floor first. Like, we weren't trying to hit home runs. We just needed to get some actual NBA players in here.
So now those who are listening who don't know, you are a humongous Miami Heat fan, correct, Rohan?
Yeah, I mean, I can't be like, well, actually, I mean, listen, I think I bring a pretty healthy perspective to my job. But yes, I grew up in South Florida and am a longtime supporter of the Miami Heat.
Yeah, I just wanted to point that out for, you know, the James Jones GM of the year vibes I was getting from you. I just wanted to clarify where exactly they might have been based out of.
He was like, you have a 954 area code? And I was like, I'm never giving it up. And he's like, I've had the same phone number since 1998. And I was like, listen, man, I was one of those people tweeting about how Spo needed to get you in the game more. The lineup stats said we were killing it when you were on the floor. He's like, I appreciate that. So, yes, and did it come up? Yeah, it came up.
Just incredible. Well, this is a perfect opportunity for us to transition to a series that I think a lot of people were looking forward to, for sure. The Miami Heat versus the Milwaukee Bucks, a rematch of last year's second round upset. They kind of launched Miami to the finals. You know, this has been covered. You are a fan of this organization, the Miami Heat. Just what is
You're
your
really hammering this home, man?
We just gotta get it out there. What is your personal like concern meter right now, coming off of Game One's overtime loss, on a scale of 1 to 10?
I mean, my personal concern is relatively low, only because I expected the Bucks to win this series pretty handily. I mean, in terms of, listen, I feel like a lot of what we say today has to be couched in what did this team do at the 3-point line, and it was only Game One. So,
yep.
You know, I hesitate to draw big conclusions from one game. We know Spo is going to make adjustments. I'm sure Bud has adjustments that he can go to. Similar to Frank Vogel, if he ever stops getting obsessed with playing his centers. I think if the Heat, you know, the positive spin is Bam and Jimmy aren't going to shoot that poorly again. Bam is going to be more aggressive. At the same time, are you going to get that kind of Duncan Robinson game again? Are you going to get that kind of Dragic game again? Are you going to shoot from three that well again at any other point in the playoffs, let alone the series? So, you know, it just depends if you want to be glass half full, glass half five. So in which case, I guess I'll go with my concern as a five, because I can ratchet it up and say these things won't happen again, or I can ratchet it down and say, okay, Jimmy and Bam just can't play that poorly in the same game again in a series. They've both, in fact, been on a run of really good playoff games, and this is their first kind of stinker in a while. So I would put it at a five, but I honestly thought the Bucks were going to win this series headed in. So, if anything, I was surprised at the fact that Miami had a chance to steal that Game One.
I think you picked over on SI.com, your prediction was Bucks in five, I believe, which really surprised me. I came into the playoffs kind of viewing this one as a toss-up, just because I have so much respect for Jimmy. I have so much respect for Bam. I think Spo is the best head coach in the entire NBA. And you look at game one, and as you said, like, the Heat shot 20 for 50 from behind the three-point line, which, like, if you take 50 threes and you shoot 40% and you lose in overtime, that's just, I don't know if that has ever happened in NBA history, particularly when the team that defeated you, they go 5 for 31. Like, wild stuff. And obviously this game could have gone either way. But, you know, one of the more interesting parts about this entire series and the Milwaukee Bucks in general is just how they deploy Brooke Lopez, particularly against, you know, like, defensively, the drop coverage has been successful over the past three seasons for the Bucks, for sure. You watch game one, and, you know, there's a couple early situations where Duncan gets free because Brooke Lopez is in the paint and completely helpless to defend a DHO with Bam, or just a pitch with Jimmy, something like that, to get Duncan wide open. And then, like, I was expecting, I mean, we probably will still see this throughout the playoffs at some point, assuming that Milwaukee advances. But I assume that PJ Tucker was going to be closing at the 5/4 in lineups that were pretty small with Giannis and Middleton and Drew, and then another small. But we didn't really get that at all, which I found to be fascinating, given that Milwaukee was still able to eke out the victory. And I actually wrote in my notebook early in the first quarter, like, Brooke Lopez needs to justify being on the court because
Brooke Lopez just keeps dropping and dropping. Like, Bam's at, you know, at the half circle. Brooke Lopez still dropping. Just, you know, I feel like he's going to end up in the concourse on some of these defensive possessions. It's crazy. Like, people are so scared of him at the rim, apparently, still, that he doesn't even have to play defense. It's the illusion of him in the paint that at this point is doing more than he himself. And that's another reason why I think the Bucks are going to win this series, is they have that ace in the hole where if they went small and they did play PJ Tucker, like I think we both expected. I spoke to PJ Tucker before the playoffs. I think he expected that. I think he intimated to me that he'd had conversations that that's how they planned on deploying him in the playoffs. So I was pretty surprised to not, you know, see that lineup in any significant fashion, like you said, with PJ at the 4/5 and Giannis in the front court with him. I just think if the Bucks committed to going to that ace in the hole, I don't think Miami would have an answer for that. And I understand that the Bucks, they don't play that way all year round. You know, they might not necessarily have the habits. Coaches love talking about habits, but it's pretty, again, shocking to me that it feels like they're playing with one hand tied behind their back sometimes by not going to this, you know, very obvious lineup that would present Miami with all sorts of problems.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. We'll kind of see how Bud adjusts throughout the series. We'll see how Spo adjusts throughout the series. I liked how Milwaukee generally was defending, particularly off ball. They were switching a little bit more. But I'm just, maybe it's just because of the struggles that Milwaukee has had over the past few seasons, I'm just really looking forward to seeing Giannis at the five. And I've always imagined, like, the Bucks hitting their ceiling in Giannis's prime. I just never, like, I can't picture Brooke Lopez being part of that.
It's not going to happen frame with another 7-footer on the floor. You're right. Yeah, it's strange. It is also funny because I think that if you somehow missed the playoffs last year and you came in and looked at these two teams, would people be giving Miami a chance? Or, like, how much of their, you know, the fact that people are saying the series can go 6-7, et cetera, is coming off what happened last year. Also, I just want to mention him because we haven't yet, but Drew Holiday, who you tweeted about and has long been one of my favorite players in the NBA, especially since that series where he was guarding KD on the Warriors when he was on the Pelicans. He is like a total game changer, wrecking ball for this Bucks team.
True maniac. I love Jrue Holiday. Yeah. It's like we talk about, I think a lot of something that people forget when they see Brook Lopez dropping is the ball, whoever's defending the ball handler, like his responsibility is to fight over the screen and prevent, like, and to recover and prevent a clean look. And Jrue Holiday is basically the best person in NBA history at this job. So I think that that is totally a factor when you see the strategies that are being deployed by Bud and having someone who is so fantastic bothering shooters and bothering ball handlers at the point of attack as Jrue does. I mean, there was that play where he just ripped Goran Dragic and took it the other way in the fourth quarter.
I couldn't believe Dragic had the game he had. He was maybe the Heat's best guy on the floor between him or Duncan, considering how well Jrue was defending him whenever they were matched up. He's, like you said, I love those guards. I mean, he was picking up guys three-quarters court, half-court also. Just the relentless ball pressure. I mean, you know, Toronto had it a little bit with Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet. Those are my favorite guys to watch. I mean, that's such a high-wire, tight-rope act to be as a guard out on an island, you know, picking someone up at half court with that ball pressure, knowing the screen is coming, but him just having the confidence that he's going to fight over it. He's going to be such a problem for any team in the East during this entire playoff run. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I'm really, really excited to see Jrue in a potential series against the Nets, just because I think he's going to be...
Blasphemous.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're getting ahead of yourself. Easy, buddy. Easy. What did I say about Rob Williams at the top? Come on.
You're right. You're right. But, you know, enough can't be said about Jrue, and I'm very happy for him that he's playing in these high-level playoff games, and I think his career is just going to have a whole new level of appreciation after some of these Bucks playoff runs, because, yeah, he's just a... People don't really, I think, fully grasp just how difficult it is for a guard to put themselves on the islands that he puts himself on and just thrives over and over again.
He doesn't even put himself on the island. The other person who has the ball is on the island with him, and they are the ones who are suffering. I think we're definitely going to check back on this series multiple times before it's through. But I want to transition really quick, Rohan, to talk about the Clippers, maybe it's fair to say that that was the biggest upset of the weekend. Clippers, Mavs, Clippers lose in a tight one. And we have this email from Thaddeus, longtime listener, who wrote us this wonderful message. Quote from Thaddeus, as I'm writing this, we are two games into the playoffs and it already feels like the Clippers may have outsmarted themselves. There's a lot of Clippers takes about little brother, losing mentality, and what it says to your team to openly tank out of a playoff spot. I get a lot of that, although it's way overblown. But as a pure value proposition, it feels like they were trying too hard. They used a simple statement, quote, avoid the Lakers, to overcomplicate what it takes to win a title. Occam's razor says the simplest answer is usually the best. If the goal is to win a title, you have to win 16 games and want the easiest path available. They may have, quote, avoided the Lakers, but it's actually much more complicated. And then Thaddeus goes on to write about 9,000 words in this wonderful email. And I'm not going to have the time, I'm sorry, Thaddeus, to read it all here. But I will succinct it all by just asking you, Rohan, are the Clippers actually in trouble, in your opinion, after watching game one?
I mean, they're trouble in the sense that they're playing a good team, right? They were never going to get an easy first-round matchup. And Luka is just one of those players that he was the best player on the floor in game one. He outplayed both PG and Kawhi, and that's going to happen. And if that happens, these aren't going to be easy wins for the Clippers. So I don't think that they're in trouble in terms of, like, oh, they cheated the game and the basketball gods are coming to, like, strike them down with karma for doing so. I don't think they're in trouble because they're a bad team or a weak team or a fragile team, etc. I just think that they have a challenge in front of them. We have to throw out the seeds here and just look and realize that these are two both good teams. I think Dallas probably would have finished with a much better record this year if they didn't have a ton of COVID issues. Are they in trouble? It's not like, you know, the Clippers drop game one and the wheels are coming off. It's just, no, like, this is a tough series. This is a good matchup, and it's going to be a challenge.
So I fundamentally agree with what you're saying, but would you be shocked if the Clippers actually lost this series? Like, no disrespect to Dallas, who I have disrespected on this podcast ad nauseum since the season started. But
apologies,
like,
to
would
Fort
you
Worth, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly. But like, would you be stunned if the Clippers just went out in the first round against this team?
Okay, I would be pretty surprised if the Clippers lost. Like we both said, no disrespect to Dallas. I've watched Shark Tank on Hulu several times during a quick lunch. You want to see a couple pitches. But yes, I would be. At the same time, you're right. No, I would be really surprised if the Clippers lost. The Clippers, again, just had the profile of a great team during the regular season, particularly when everyone was healthy. They seemingly would have the multiple defenders needed to guard this offense. So you're right. I would be pretty surprised if the Clippers lost. I did pick the Clippers to win. I just felt like a classic game one overreaction email to me, in the sense that, like, the playoffs are a challenge. Like, they're not meant to be easy. And, you know, that doesn't exempt even a team like the Clippers with players as good as Kawhi and PG on it, you know, to drop some games. They were down 2-1 to Dallas last year. So my bigger point is, like, these things happen in the playoffs. We saw the Lakers and Bucks lose both their game ones in the first round last year and then sweep the rest of the way. So, you know, my point is just that these things happen. But, yeah, I would be surprised if the Clippers lost the round, certainly.
So I wrote on the site today about this series, and something that really interested me was just how the Clippers would defend all the, you know, Luka Doncic. Defending Luka Doncic just presents all these different challenges, particularly in the pick and roll. And the Clippers have so many different ways that they can attack him and different schemes that they can execute really well at a high level. They have so much length, so much athleticism, so many great individual pieces to throw at him and to, you know, they can switch, they can trap, they can drop, they can recover off of those blitzes really, really well. And they communicate off ball splendidly. And their defensive rating during the regular season when PG and Kawhi was on the floor was like 2 points better than the first place Lakers. And in game one, when Kawhi and PG were on the court, Clippers defensive rating was like 132 or something. Ooh. Like, just like totally outrageous stuff that I don't feel is that sustainable. And, you know, in watching this game, I had no issue with anything defensively that the Clippers did, really. And you texted me. I'm going to out you right now. I'm sorry. But you texted me during the game about Ivica Zubats, and just, you know, he was getting roasted on switches, and the Mavs were hunting him down, as they should. And that was a situation where it's safe to say that Luka was putting someone on an island. And there were step-back threes. There were step-backs in the corner. There were, like, one-legged fallaways from the elbow, these turnarounds that are impossible for anyone else except Luka, and he was just swishing everything. And so, you know, you watch those clips, and you're like, okay, if you're the Clippers, you'll live with these shots. They were really difficult. Most of them were contested. I thought Zubats did a pretty good job, just technically, with how he wants to defend Luka. Keep him out of the paint. Keep him at bay. The jumpers are good. But, like, when the Clippers actually blitzed and were super aggressive with Luka and squeezed the ball from his hands, Dallas's offense was just, like, helpless for stretches. And I see a lot more of that happening as the series goes on, honestly. Like, Luka scored 1 point in the fourth quarter of that game, which is kind of a ridiculous stat since he finished with 31.
And it's also funny, because sometimes you watch a game like that and you're like, well, this guy's unstoppable. Like, they have no answer for him. And it's like, well, if that were true, like, Luka would never lose a basketball game. You know what I mean? It's like, people are watching and it's like, well, there's no, you know, whatever defensive coverage they throw, like, nothing is going to work. Like, that's not true. I mean, if I'm not saying Luka's not a great player, but, like, if LeBron James can be slowed down to a degree in the playoffs, like, so can Luka Doncic. Like, anyone can be slowed down to a degree. I thought it was a little absurd neither Kawhi nor PG were guarding him also in the fourth quarter. I know you mentioned he didn't even blow up, but they were guarding him with Rondo and then throwing these traps at him, but then Dallas was all of a sudden getting dunks. It was, you know, the reason I texted you about Zubac, not even that I was, like, you know, trying to pick on him, but something that you wrote about way earlier in the season was the Clippers have the, you know, potential to play five forwards at once, basically. Mm-hmm. They can go Kawhi, PG, Marcus Morris, Nick Batum, and Serge Ibaka, which kind of seems like this is the perfect lineup to try against this Mavs team, because you can either switch everything, you have enough athleticism to trap and just kind of recover and scramble. I'm not saying that it's as simple as this. I would just personally like to see Kawhi Leonard, one of the all-time great perimeter defenders, guarding the other team's best guy in the fourth quarter. Am I crazy for suggesting that idea? I'm not saying that alone is what's going to fix the Clippers' defense and shut down Luka. And I understand that you're asking Kawhi to do a lot offensively. I just was a little bit taken aback that you have these, you know, two of the best, if not the two best and or most respected perimeter defenders in the NBA, and for large stretches of the fourth quarter, they're not guarding the other team's best player. You know, I understand that they're trying to do certain things with help defense, etc. I thought they were, you know, trying to be a little bit too clever there. One strategy that I think could work for the Clippers, if they don't want to be, you know, switching everything, etc. You know, we saw the Heat last year in the finals, you know, when LeBron would try to hunt for switches, they'd have the guy he'd want to hunt, you know, hedge a little bit, and basically have the primary defender, which was in most cases Jimmy Butler, kind of scramble back, live mm-hmm. with the threes. I understand, you know, Luka's become a much better shooter over the course of the regular season, but I wonder if you have to live with the strategy like that, because I don't think the Mavs offense from game one was sustainable, but they were also getting a lot of easy looks in that fourth quarter when the Clippers were blitzing.
Yeah, I mean, you make a couple of really good points there. I think that one of the reasons why you don't put Kawhi on Luka, which they did that a little bit, and the Mavs responded basically by just setting a bunch of early screens and forcing Kawhi to switch off of Luka. So that if you, like, put him on to start a possession and then all of a sudden he switched off with like 18 seconds on the shot clock, it's like, okay, why did we do that? So putting Kawhi on someone like Kristaps, which just, like, totally neutralizes the Luka KP pick and roll, which was devastating throughout the entire season. Like, you just switch that, and it just, like, they have to go away from it and can't go to it because Kawhi would just switch onto Luka, and that defeats the whole purpose. So I think that probably played into the calculus a little bit. And Kristaps got free a couple times on some slips and got a couple dunks in the fourth, which were good. But, like, Tim Hardaway Jr. hit some shots that were just out of his mind shots. Like, Dorian Finney-Smith hit a couple open threes that were non-corner, and he'll hit those sometimes. But if you're the Clippers, you love that. Like, you don't. I would much rather have Dorian Finney-Smith either taking a contested non-corner three or, you know, having to beat Reggie Jackson off the dribble with 6 seconds on the shot clock. Like, that is, and those were situations that the Clippers were able to put the Mavs in because of how aggressive they were with Luka late. So that's just something I'm looking forward to kind of going forward. And I would be stunned considering I picked the Clippers to win the NBA championship if they were to lose in this series. I love everything about this team. And I just think that's absolutely everything, every inch, every nook, every cranny. But like sometimes in the NBA, like, yeah, it's hard to win games, sure. And sometimes teams just get ridiculously hot in a 48-minute stretch, which I think is what happened in game one to the Clippers. Okay, now an email from our good friend Colin B. Colin writes in, as a Portland State University alumni, I have to ask a question about my Blazers. What do you think of this series from a matchup standpoint? I know a lot of Blazers fans wanted the Nuggets, but I am personally terrified of Nikola Jokic and Michael Porter Jr. It has been quite a wild season for the Blazers, but this recent stretch with the addition of Norm Powell has me very optimistic for the future. Personally, I think the Blazers should be okay with Jokic getting his, and they should try to shut down Porter. I want to know what you guys think the Blazers need to do to pull this series off. And so... Thank you, Colin, for that question. It was wonderful. Rohan, you picked the Nuggets in this series, and I believe everyone except me, who works for SI, picked the Nuggets in this series.
Convenient for you to bring up this I know. Email after Colin, game one. Okay.
Colin B., alias Michael Pina. Do you still feel great about picking the Nuggets? And kind of can you actually like explain why you did? Because I was actually a little surprised that so many people were siding with Denver in this one.
Honestly, this was the series I had the least feel for, and I never felt great about picking the Nuggets. I would say I was a little bit, you know, hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray by just how well the Nuggets finished down the stretch. I mean, I was like pretty out on the Nuggets after the Jamal injury and was shocked about the run they went on. You know, MPJ was playing out of his mind. They were not merely surviving, but even thriving during Facu Campazzo minutes. The Facu Campazzo roller coaster, like, just really needs to be its own documentary one day.
Yes.
Where this guy was just getting killed in bench lineups earlier in the year. Now they're like, yep, go guard Dame Lillard. It's absurd. No, I mean, I never felt great about it. I think really what I landed on was Jokic has been playing so well. He's obviously the MVP. This just felt like a series that maybe he could gut out somehow. You know, game one, I also think that there are, you know, elements that the Nuggets played well, and obviously they're going to need to figure out something else on Dame. You know, it's really a shame. Marcus Howard playing minutes, it's not even that he played poorly, but even if they had one of PJ Dozier or Will Barton, let alone both, I mean, if they just had one of those guys, I think that makes a huge difference in this series, just to buy them some more competitive defensive minutes on one of Portland's guards. But MPJ, while he shot great from the field, I believe he made only 1 3. He's been one of the better three-point shooters in the league this year. So I do think there are, you know, areas where the Nuggets can say, okay, we're not going to do this poorly again, etc. But honestly, I never felt great about this series. I think, honestly, the explanation for my pick was it didn't feel like a toss-up, but I'm just going to go with the MVP because I do think Jokic can steal them a couple games in this series. The Nuggets, though, they did just look... They had a weird flatness to them in game one.
Yeah, I think, it. You know, I picked Portland for a variety of reasons, but it really hit me when I was watching game one and I saw Austin Rivers and Facu on the court at the same time, and I was just like... You know, this is a really bad matchup for Denver. Like, Dame Lillard, CJ McCollum, Norm Powell, Anthony Simons just, like, bombing away, suddenly just becoming this trusted piece in Terry Stotts' rotation. A huge development, I think. Like, I don't know. I look at that, and I understand how dominant Jokic is, but, like, you put Nurk on him. You don't help off the shooters. You stick like glue to all the cutters and how they like to function on offense with Jokic kind of just dictating action. And I mean, it was, I don't know what Denver does to kind of combat this, because defensively they were just picking on Jokic in the pick and roll over and over and over again. And Dame just, I mean, it was torture. Just, it's really a bad matchup for him, and it's a bad matchup for Denver. Because you can't take Jokic out of the game. He's obviously way more too valuable for you on the offensive end. And something that I noticed that, you know, the Blazers did a little bit towards the end of the season, but not so much, is, you know, like, Dame plays the entire first quarter of every game. And usually, you know, you get into the second quarter, and that's just like an opportunity to exhale if you're the opponent. Obviously, you know, you spent this 12 minutes covering this guy who's just like, mm-hmm, pulling up from 35 feet. And now with Terry Stotts' new rotation, like, they have Anfernee Simons, Norm Powell, C.J. McCollum, Carmelo Anthony, and Enes Kanter starting second quarters. And that group, it's like, that is a murderer's row offensively. Yeah. I don't know how you defend that five-man unit. And it's supposed to be this reprieve because Dame is resting, and you just don't get that opportunity. Now, defensively, that group is, to be kind, atrocious individually. There's just a lot of warts there that can be attacked.
Yes,
exactly. Yeah. But I think defending them, like, there's just no time to take a breath with this Portland team. And Dame's going to play a ton of minutes, and CJ's rounding into form, and Norm Powell is Norm Powell, really good, playing for a new contract. I love the way they penetrated. I love the way they were unselfish in game one. They had an unusually high assist rate, and it showed on the floor when you were watching, just a ton of open spot up threes. Like, I don't want to say that this series is over, but I also was pretty confident when I picked the Blazers, and I was just surprised that so many went against them.
No, you're right. And it is funny because I think a couple years ago when they had the seven-game series, you know, and that was Jokic's first playoff run, that was a series that I was most interested in watching play because I was like, how is he going to survive against a guy like Dame? And he actually held up pretty well in that series, and I think has held up well enough defensively since then. You know, where the Nuggets start to run into a problem is, you know, without Murray, they can't get into basically what's been their fourth quarter offense, you know, during the last few playoffs, which is let's just keep running Murray, Jokic, pick and rolls until the wheels fall off and they have to adjust to that. Beyond that, how about Michael Malone calling out Michael Porter Jr.? That was so. First of all, shout out to Coach Malone, who for years now has been given the only coach trying during in-quarter interviews, like the only one taking this seriously. Like, the TV partners have to love this guy. Like, they should retire his suit or something. The way he gives these eloquent answers during his in-quarter interviews, it's like, buddy, you don't need to try this hard, okay? Nobody else is. But even he was like, yeah, you know, Dame's trying to get Michael Porter Jr. on the switch, like, every time down the floor. We got to see what we're doing about that. It's like, I don't remember the last time a coach singled out a player as someone who's getting targeted on defense during their in-quarter interview. And I think that's where the Nuggets are running into a huge problem. And one that I think have also always wondered is, you know, what about MPJ defensively in the playoffs? When you throw in the fact, like you said, that there's going to be minutes where Austin Rivers and Facu Campazzo are sharing the floor, you know, will the Nuggets basically have enough defenders to hold up during the series? I'm not sure. And I'm not surprised that you picked the Blazers. I wouldn't have been like, this one was, I think, definitely the hardest series for me to pick. You know, I do think that the Nuggets have always responded to playoff losses under Malone. So now I'm just like so nervous to say his name. Like, oh my God, if I call him Mike, he's going to find me. But I would be surprised if it wasn't a series only because whether it was Murray going down or, you know, the crazy playoff series they've had the last couple of years, for what it's worth, the Nuggets do seem to find a way to respond in these series.
Yeah, I just try to separate the regular season from the playoffs in like very dramatically in my brain and really just try to stick to what matchups are in front, because yes, the Nuggets looked really good after Jamal went down, which I don't think a lot of people expected, but this regular season was just so weird, man. Like,
on this regular season and what it means for some playoff teams.
I mean, no, like, if you were to go back and just look and see, okay, who was available that the Nuggets played, like, you can't just look at the teams. You got to see was actually playing, who was out
which
because of health and safety
the
protocols.
Which teams in the East had 9 months off before the playoffs started, or before the season started, rather. There's a lot to discuss about the regular season for sure. No, you're right. You're right. I think this year especially, you were going to see a stark difference. I think teams are going to be trying in a way defensively they were not during the regular season. So I think that's a fair point. That's definitely a fair point where I think this year more than ever, these series are going to be, you know, really, really matchup dependent.
Okay. So we have this email from Joel, who writes in about the Grizzlies Jazz series, which is very spicy all of a sudden. So Jill writes, quote, it is weird to me that no sports writers or commentators leading up to this series seem to wonder if Donovan Mitchell would actually be back. He's been out over a month, and unless he just magically happened or happens to be 100% as the series starts, it's my guess that even if he comes back at some point, it won't be a full tilt version of him for a number of games. I'm picking the Grizzlies in seven, so you two will be bold and predict a Grizzlies seven-game win? And Joel wanted me to read that question in Ben Golliver's voice, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to throw it to you, Rohan, and you take it away.
Well, first of all, I just want to say, people, when they pick the underdog to win in seven games, like, love to forget that, like, the Grizzlies are almost definitely not winning a road game seven. I love the Grizzlies, but teams don't win road game sevens. I just want to throw that out there. It happens very rarely. The 2016 Cavs, a notable exception, but, like, if you're going to pick an upset for an underdog, just do it in six games. That's just for future reference. The Donovan Mitchell thing is weird. I do think that we all kind of glossed over that, but also, you know, today apparently he's upset that the team held him out. This ESPN story is like, they're going to get Dwayne Wade in there to smooth it over. I was like, not expecting Dwayne Wade's name to pop up this early in a playoff series in 2021. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to be fine. I think the reason none of us were concerned about it is because the Jazz had every reason to be overly cautious with a number one seed. Why bring him back, like you said, during this weird regular season, etc. I don't know that I'm going to pick the Grizzlies. I think the obvious thing we can talk about from game one is, will the Jazz miss that many threes again in this series? Or is there something we said about some people never really had confidence in their shooters and said, wait until the playoffs when teams are trying a little bit harder or just ignoring certain guys. What's that going to do to them? They missed shots that they were making during the regular season. So, you know, I think that is maybe where you are slightly raising an eyebrow at Utah. But this was a really close game. The Jazz were playing really well when Gobert didn't have foul trouble. So I really like Memphis. I feel like, you know, it's easy to keep underestimating them. And I don't want to be the guy that's like, but the Jazz are definitely winning this series. But similar to the Clippers-Mavs, I'd be pretty surprised if the Jazz lost.
I don't think that there's anyone more unstoppable in the entire NBA right now than Dylan Brooks. So I just want to get that on the record. His surges when he's just like, you know, he'll hit some ridiculous contested jump shot and then he'll blow by his man. He did that like reverse between the legs, getting downhill and one layup.
Dude, he's just like spinning out of nowhere. Like, he just comes in like Captain Marvel at the end of Avengers Endgame, just like, you know, flying through spaceships and stuff. He doesn't care. It's awesome. He's always jumping. I feel like he spends half the time he's on the court in the air. Like, offensive rebounds, he's higher than everybody else at all times. He's awesome.
He is so good. The surges that he goes on are just incredible. I guess, like, to just answer this question, I just assumed Donovan would play. I mean, it's the playoffs. He'd been out for a really long time. It's a sprained ankle. He was practicing. He seemed to be coming along. I mean, he was at shoot around.
He was seemingly cleared to play as early as, like, you know, yesterday morning. So something weird happened there. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, that was just like my personal feelings. Donovan Mitchell is an all time competitor, and I wouldn't. It's understandable that he is upset that the team kept him out. And I think it's really interesting when you just look at how that game unfolded, and it like doesn't even seem like an upset to me because the Grizzlies the healthy Grizzlies versus the Jazz without their best player is pretty evenly matched, I would say. So I'm not like, and we're talking about Dylan Brooks. Like, Dylan Brooks would have been guarding Donovan Mitchell. That is exhausting. So Dylan Brooks is not scoring 31 or however many points he did if Donovan Mitchell is in that game, and he's drawing the primary defensive assignment and he's shadowing him like he did Steph Curry in that play-in game. Like, that's just not going to happen. So I think as soon as Donovan comes back, things will kind of straighten. I wouldn't be surprised if the Jazz 1-5, to be honest. Like, I think playing in Memphis will be a really difficult atmosphere, and that team is super young and super confident, but game one just seemed like it seemed very obvious to me why Memphis won. It was because the other team's best player, arguably, I would say Donovan is their best player, wasn't available. That's just how I kind of read it.
I agree. And, I touched on the shooting. I'm loath to agree with Charles Barkley in most instances, but there is also something you said, if Donovan was playing in that game, or if Donovan is playing in game two and the shots still aren't falling, he's the kind of guy who can collapse the defense and or get to the rim, score at the rim, etc., kind of help stop the bleeding in those moments when none of the outside shots are falling. Can we talk about Gobert for a second, though?
Of course.
The flop. In terms of just, like, most embarrassing things you've ever seen on an NBA court, where did that rank for you? Let me just set the scene. He had fouled out. He went to go mean mug someone while he was waiting, in the bench area after falling out. The person he's mean mugging clearly could not care less that he's being mean mugged by Rudy Gobert. Like, just like, get out of my face, man. Like, you're not even involved in this anymore. And he just, takes like an SNL-esque dive to the ground.
You really don't like Rudy Gobert. Let's just put it on the table right now.
It's not that I dislike him, have anything against him personally, etc. It's more so that it's like certain people are trying so hard to sell you on the idea of Rudy Gobert that I'm like, let's just relax. Like why are you shoving this Rudy Gobert propaganda in my face all the time? It's like, it's kind of just like a self-fulfilling prophecy where it's like, they're like, people don't like Rudy Gobert, so we're going to be really, really aggressive in telling you how good he is. But then that is, in fact, what is making people not like Rudy Gobert.
So you're not a big screen assist guy, I take it?
I'm not a huge screen assist guy, unless it's Bam. Unless we're talking about a way to give Bam's game even more. Then I'm a huge screen assist guy. But, Hassan Whiteside, I bet he piled up a lot of screen assists.
I don't think we're going to get a lot of friendly emails to that comment. Yeah. I'll just real quickly go to bat for Rudy. I mean, I think he's really good. I don't think he played particularly well. I don't think he played particularly well in game one. Fouling out is not what you want. But there was that one play where Ja Morant tried to challenge him at the rim, and Ja is just like levitating in midair and like doing crazy things with the ball. Yeah, Gobert, like the timing, I think that is a really underrated quality to be able to time your jump, to locate the ball with your hands, and to block it.
He is good. He's obviously very impactful. He's the reason they've had a great defense for so long. The flop was just embarrassing.
Okay. Rohan, do you have anything more to say about anything other disparaging comments about the Utah Jazz, the fan base, their franchise players?
No,
do you have anything
I don't.
Else you want to get off your chest before we wrap this up?
I think, obviously, starting with Dwayne at the top, it's a very classy organization. embellishing contact is something Dwayne Wade would never do, and I'm sure he's going to have a conversation with Rudy about it and get that cleaned up before game two. So
wonderful. All right, Rohan. I think that does it for today's show. I want to thank real quickly the Open Floor Globe for listening in and sending all those wonderful emails. When you are typing through fury, please remember that I was not the one who was bad-mouthing the Utah Jazz.
I forgot that Open Floor is very popular in Utah. Listen, Utah, I'm dying to come visit and check out the national parks, etc. I just want to see Rudy keep that stuff on the court where he's a great player and, you know, chill with the, I fouled out, let me try to draw a tech flops. That's it. That's all I'm saying.
It's clearly too late for apologies. listeners, please email the show with any and every question you can possibly think of. Hit us up at openfloormail@gmail.com. That is openfloormail@gmail.com. Until later this week when I will be joined by Chris, everyone stay safe and continue to enjoy watching the NBA playoffs.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.